Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. So we've been going through Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times number one bestseller from 2004. What it does is go into a very deep foundational level for why we're in the kind of debt we are individually, nationally, and globally. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I highly recommend that you read. In 1974, a diplomat from Saudi Arabia showed John photos of Riyadh, the capital of his country. Included in these photos was a herd of goats rummaging among piles of refuse outside a government building. When John asked the diplomat about them, his response shocked John. He told John that they were the city's main garbage disposal system. No self-respecting Saudi would ever collect trash, he said. We leave it to the beasts. In the capital of the world's greatest oil kingdom, it seemed unbelievable. At the time, John was one of a group of consultants just beginning to try to piece together a solution to the oil crisis. Those goats led him to an understanding of how that solution might evolve, especially given the country's pattern of development over the previous three centuries. Saudi Arabia's history is full of violence and religious fanaticism. In the 18th century, Muhammad ibn Saud, a local warlord, joined forces with fundamentalists from the ultra-conservative Wahhabi sect. It was a powerful union, and during the next 200 years, the Saud family and their Wahhabi allies conquered most of the Arabian Peninsula, including Islam's holiest sites, Mecca and Medina. Saudi society reflected the puritanical idealism of its founders, and a strict interpretation of Quranic beliefs was enforced. Religious police ensured adherence to the mandate to pray five times a day. Women were required to cover themselves from head to toe. Punishment for criminals was severe. Public executions and stonings were common. During John's first visit to Riyadh, he was amazed when his driver told him he could leave his camera, briefcase, and even his wallet in plain sight inside a car parked near the open market without locking it. No one, the driver said, would think of stealing here. Thieves have their hands cut off. Later that day, The driver asked John if he would like to visit a so-called Chop Chop Square and watch a beheading. Wahhabism's adherence to what we would consider extreme Puritanism made the streets safe from thieves and demanded the harshest form of corporal punishment for those who violated the laws. John declined the invitation. The Saudi view of religion as an important element of politics and economics contributed to the oil embargo that shook the Western world. On October 6, 1973, Yom Kippur, the holiest of Jewish holidays, Egypt and Syria launched simultaneous attacks on Israel. It was the beginning of the October War, the fourth and most destructive of the Arab-Israeli wars, and the one that would have the greatest impact on the world. Egypt's president, Sadat, pressured Saudi Arabia's King Faisal to retaliate against the United States' complicity with Israel by employing what Sadat referred to as the oil weapon. On October 16th, Iran and the five Arab Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, announced a 70% increase in the posted price of oil. Meeting in Kuwait City, Arab oil ministers pondered further options. The Iraqi representatives were vehemently in favor of targeting the United States. He called on the other delegates to nationalize American businesses in the Arab world, to impose a total oil embargo on the United States and on all other nations friendly to Israel, and to withdraw Arab funds from every American bank. He pointed out that Arab bank accounts were substantial and that this action could result in a panic not unlike that of 1929. Other Arab ministers were reluctant to agree to such a radical plan, but on October 17th, they did decide to move forward with a more limited embargo, which would begin with a 5% cut in production and then impose an additional 5% reduction every month until their political objectives were met. They agreed that the United States should be punished for its pro-Israeli stance and should therefore have the most severe embargo levied against it. Several of the countries attending the meeting announced that they would implement cutbacks of 10% rather than 5%. On October 19th, President Nixon asked Congress for $2.2 billion in aid to Israel. The next day, Saudi Arabia and other Arab producers imposed a total embargo on oil shipments to the United States. The oil embargo ended on March 18, 1974. Its duration was short, its impact immense. The selling price of Saudi oil leaped from $1.39 a barrel on January 1, 1970 to $8.32 on January 1, 1974. Politicians and future administrations would never forget the lessons learned during the early to mid-1970s. In the long run, the trauma of those few months served to strengthen the corporatocracy. Its three pillars, big corporations, international banks, and government, bonded as never before. That bond would endure. The embargo also resulted in significant attitude and policy changes. It convinced Wall Street and Washington that such an embargo could never again be tolerated. Protecting our oil supplies had always been a priority. After 1973, it became an obsession. The embargo elevated Saudi Arabia's status as a player in the world politics and forced Washington to recognize the kingdom's strategic importance to our own economy. Furthermore, it encouraged U.S. corporatocracy leaders to search desperately for methods to funnel petrodollars back to America and to ponder the fact that the Saudi government lacked the administrative and institutional frameworks to properly manage its mushrooming wealth. For Saudi Arabia, the additional oil income resulting from the price hikes was a mixed blessing. It filled the national coffers with billions of dollars. However, it also served to undermine some of the strict religious beliefs of the Wahhabis. Wealthy Saudis traveled around the world. They attended schools and universities in Europe and the United States. They bought fancy cars and furnished their houses with Western-style goods. Conservative religious beliefs were replaced by a new form of materialism, and it was this materialism that presented a solution to fears of future oil crises. And I'll return to this in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Almost immediately after the embargo ended, Washington began negotiating with the Saudis, offering them technical support, military hardware and training, and an opportunity to bring their nation into the 20th century in exchange for petrodollars and, most important, assurances that there would never again be another oil embargo. The negotiations resulted in the creation of a most extraordinary organization, the United States-Saudi Arabian Joint Economic Commission. Known as G-Corps, it embodied an innovative concept that was the opposite of traditional foreign aid programs. It relied on Saudi money to hire American firms to build up Saudi Arabia. Although overall management and fiscal responsibility were delegated to the U.S. Department of the Treasury, this commission was independent to the extreme. Ultimately, it would spend billions of dollars over a period of more than 25 years with virtually no congressional oversight. Because no U.S. funding was involved, Congress had no authority in the matter, despite Treasury's role. After studying G-Corps extensively, David Holden and Richard Johns concluded it was the most far-reaching agreement of its kind ever concluded by the U.S. with a developing country. It had the potential to entrench the U.S. deeply in the kingdom, fortifying the concept of mutual interdependence. The Department of Treasury brought Maine in at an early stage to serve as an advisor. John was summoned and told that his job would be critical and that everything he did and learned should be considered highly confidential. From his vantage point, it seemed like a clandestine operation. At the time, he was led to believe that Maine was the lead consultant in that process. He subsequently came to realize that they were one of several consultants whose expertise was sought. Since everything was done in the greatest secrecy, John was not privy to Treasury's discussions with other consultants, and he therefore cannot be certain about the importance of his role in this precedent-setting deal. He does know that the arrangements established new standards for economic hitmen and that it launched innovative alternatives to the traditional approaches for advancing the interests of empire. He also knows that most of the scenarios that evolved from his studies were ultimately implemented, that Maine was rewarded with one of the first major and extremely profitable contracts in Saudi Arabia, and that he received a large bonus that year. John's job was to develop forecasts of what might happen in Saudi Arabia if vast amounts of money were invested in its infrastructure, and to map out scenarios for spending that money. In short, he was asked to apply as much creativity as he could to justify the infusions of hundreds of millions of dollars into the Saudi Arabian economy under conditions that would include U.S. engineering and construction companies. He was told to do this on his own, not to rely on his staff, and John was sequestered in a small conference room several floors above the one where his department was located. He was warned that his job was both a matter of national security and potentially very lucrative for Maine. He understood, of course, that the primary objective here was not the usual, to burden this country with debts it could never repay, but rather to find ways that would assure that a large portion of petrodollars found their way back to the United States. In the process, Saudi Arabia would be drawn in, its economy would become increasingly intertwined with and dependent upon the U.S.'s, and presumably it would grow more westernized and therefore more sympathetic with and integrated into the U.S. system. Once John got started, he realized that the goats wandering the streets of Riyadh were the symbolic key. They were a sore point among Saudis jet-setting around the world. Those goats begged to be replaced by something more appropriate for this desert kingdom that craved entry into the modern world. John also knew that OPEC economists were stressing the need for oil-rich countries to obtain more value-added products for their petroleum. Rather than simply exporting crude oil, the economists were urging these countries to develop industries of their own, to use this oil to produce petroleum-based products they could sell to the rest of the world at a higher price than that brought by the crude itself. This twin realization opened the door to a strategy John felt certain would be a win-win situation for everyone. The goats, of course, were merely an entry point. Oil revenues could be employed to hire U.S. companies to replace the goats with the world's most modern garbage collection and disposal system, and the Saudis could take great pride in the state-of-the-art technology. John came to think of the goats as one side of an equation that could be applied to most of the kingdom's economic sectors, a formula for success in the eyes of the royal family, the U.S. Department of the Treasury, and his bosses at Maine. Under this formula, money would be earmarked to create an industrial sector focused on transforming raw petroleum into finished products for export. Large petrochemical complexes would rise from the desert, and around them, huge industrial parks. Naturally, such a plan would also require the construction of thousands of megawatts of electrical generating capacity, transmission and distribution lines, highways, pipelines, communication networks, and transportation systems, including new airports, improved seaports, a vast array of service industries, and the infrastructure essential to keep all these cogs turning. They all had high expectations that this plan would evolve into a model of how things should be done in the rest of the world. Globe-trotting Saudis would sing U.S. praises. They would invite leaders from many countries to come to Saudi Arabia and witness the miracles the U.S. had accomplished. Those leaders would then call on Maine to help them devise similar plans for their countries, and in most cases, for countries outside the ring of OPEC, would arrange World Bank or other debt-ridden methods for financing them. The global empire would be well served. As John worked through these ideas, he thought of the goats, and the words of his driver often echoed in his ears. No self-respecting Saudi would ever collect trash. John had heard that refrain repeatedly in many different contexts. It was obvious that the Saudis had no intention of putting their own people to work at menial tasks, whether as laborers in industrial facilities or in the actual construction of any of the projects. In the first place, there were too few of them. In addition, the Royal House of Saud had indicated a commitment to providing its citizens with a level of education and a lifestyle that were inconsistent with those of manual laborers. The Saudis might manage others, but they had no desire or motivation to become factory and construction workers. Therefore, it would be necessary to import a labor force from other countries, countries where labor was cheap and where people needed work. If possible, the labor should come from other Middle Eastern or Islamic countries, such as Egypt, Palestine, Pakistan, and Yemen. This prospect created an even greater new stratagem for development opportunities. Mammoth housing complexities would have to be constructed for these laborers, as would shopping malls, hospitals, fire and police department facilities, water and sewage treatment plants, electrical communications and transportation networks. In fact, the end result would be to create modern cities where once only deserts had existed. Here, too, was the opportunity to explore emerging technologies in, for example, desalinization plants, microwave systems, healthcare complexes, and computer technologies. And I'll return to this in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I am speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Saudi Arabia was a planner's dream come true, and also a fantasy realized for anyone associated with the engineering and construction business. It presented an economic opportunity unrivaled by any other in history. An underdeveloped country with virtually unlimited financial resources and a desire to enter the modern age in a big way, very quickly. John must admit that he enjoyed this job immensely. There was no solid data available in Saudi Arabia, in the Boston Public Library, or anywhere else that justified the use of econometric models in this context. In fact, the magnitude of the job, the total and immediate transformation of an entire nation on a scale never before witnessed, meant that even had historical data existed, it would have been irrelevant. Nor was anyone expecting this type of quantitative analysis, at least not at this stage of the game. John simply put his imagination to work and wrote reports that envisioned a glorious future for the kingdom. He had rule-of-thumb numbers he could use to estimate such things as the approximate cost to produce a megawatt of electricity, a mile of road, or adequate water, sewage, housing, food, and public services for one laborer. He was not supposed to refine these estimates or to draw final conclusions. His job was simply to describe a series of plans, more accurately perhaps visions, of what might be possible and to arrive at rough estimates of the costs associated with them. John always kept in mind the true objectives, maximizing payouts to U.S. firms and making Saudi Arabia increasingly dependent on the United States. It did not take long to realize how closely the two went together. Almost all the newly developed projects would require continual upgrading and servicing, and they were so highly technical as to assure that the companies that originally developed them would have to maintain and modernize them. In fact, as John moved forward with his work, he began to assemble two lists for each of the projects he envisioned. One for the types of design and construction contracts they could expect, and another for long-term service and maintenance agreements. Maine, Bechtel, Brown & Root, Halliburton, Stone & Webster, and many other U.S. engineers and contractors would profit handsomely for decades to come. Beyond the purely economic, there was another twist that would render Saudi Arabia dependent on the U.S., though in a very different way. The modernization of this oil-rich kingdom would trigger adverse reactions. For instance, conservative Muslims would be furious. Israel and other neighboring countries would feel threatened. The economic development of this nation was likely to spawn the growth of another industry, protecting the Arabian Peninsula. Private companies specializing in such activities, as well as the U.S. military and defense industry, could expect generous contracts and, once again, long-term service and maintenance agreements. Their presence would require another phase of engineering and construction projects, including airports, missile sites, personnel bases, and all of the infrastructure associated with such facilities. John sent his reports in sealed envelopes through inter-office mail, addressed to the Treasury Department project manager. He occasionally met with a couple of other members of the team, vice presidents at Maine and his superiors. Since they had no official name for this project, which was still in the research and development phase and was not yet part of G-Corps, they referred to it only and with hushed voices as SAMA. Ostensibly, this stood for Saudi Arabian Money Laundering Affair, but it was also a tongue-in-cheek play on words. The kingdom's central bank was called the Saudi Arabian Monetary Agency, or SAMA. Sometimes a treasury representative would join them. He asked few questions during the meetings. Mainly, John just described his work, responded to their comments, and agreed to try to do whatever was asked of him. The vice presidents and treasury representatives were especially impressed with John's ideas about the long-term service and management agreements. It prodded one of the vice presidents to coin a phrase they often used after that, referring to the kingdom as the cow we can milk until the sun sets on our retirement. For John, that phrase always conjured images of goats rather than cows. It was during those meetings that John came to realize that several of their competitors were involved in similar tasks, and that, in the end, they all expected to be awarded lucrative contracts as a result of their efforts. John assumed that Maine and the other firms were footing the bill for this preliminary work, taking a short-term risk in order to throw their hats into the ring. This assumption was reinforced by the fact that the number he charged his time to on their daily personal timesheet appeared to be a general and administrative overhead account. Such an approach was typical of the research and development proposal preparation phase of most projects. In this case, the initial investment certainly far exceeded the norm, but those vice presidents seemed extremely confident about the payback. Despite the knowledge that their competitors were also involved, they all assumed that there was enough work to go around. John also had been in the business long enough to believe that the rewards bestowed would reflect the level of Treasury's acceptance of the work they had done, and that those consultants who came up with the approaches that were finally implemented would receive the choicest contracts. John took it as a personal challenge to create scenarios that would make it to the design and construct stage. His star was already rapidly rising at Maine. Being a key player in SAMA would graduate its acceleration if they were successful. During their meetings, they also openly discussed the likelihood that SAMA and the entire G-Corps operation would set new precedents. It represented an innovative approach to creating lucrative work in countries that did not need to incur debts through the international banks. Iran and Iraq came immediately to mind as two additional examples of such countries. Moreover, given human nature, they felt that the leaders of such countries would likely be motivated to try to emulate Saudi Arabia. There seemed little doubt that the 1973 oil embargo, which had initially appeared to be so negative, would end up offering many unexpected gifts to the engineering and construction business and would help to further pave the road to global empire. John worked on that visionary phase for about 8 months, although never for more than several intense days at a time, sequestered in his private conference room or in his apartment overlooking Boston Common. His staff all had other assignments and pretty much took care of themselves, although he checked in on them periodically. Over time, the secrecy around his work declined. More people became aware that something big involving Saudi Arabia was going on. Excitement swelled, rumors swirled. The vice presidents and treasury representatives grew more open, in part, John believes, because they themselves became privy to more information as details about the ingenious scheme emerged. And I will continue in the next show. Again, we're going through The Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.